point about that particular kind of work is that certainly we ultimately did learn how to mold it, and we have a number of patents in that area. But the very fact that we had a continuous board extrusion plant did more to suppress our involvement in that type of work than anything else, because the ultimately, in about 1955, Coppers took a license from Battersea, and they started manufacturing expandable beads here. We had the whole thing on the shelf ready to go, but we would not manufacture. Well, once Coppers did, then it was a management decision that we will make expandable polystyrene beads too. So we got out there. The only thing was that it was very important to Coppers and my counterparts there, Al Ingram and some of those folks, told me the story later on that for them, you know, to get into foam via the bead route was extremely important because of they wanted to compete, did not have an extrusion process, and Al had tied that up pretty good. But he said they made it go. They put plenty of people in marketing, and they even set up a molding demonstration in a major hotel in New York at the time and invited 1,000 people to come and see them. So they dominated. They won the game, hands down, as far as I'm concerned on that. We manufactured expandable beads for 13, 14 years, and it was never really the success that it could have been for Dow, because they actually gave it to the wrong people. They gave it to people, the regular polystyrene granule salesmen, to sell. It required more technical service. It was it was more of a specialty product. So Dow never really made out well on it. But about the same time, I had learned a fair amount of stuff. Of course, on polymer structure and viscoelastic behavior and blowing agent behavior, and no one had was successfully producing a polyethylene foam at the time. So I became very much interested in how to make a foam out of polyethylene. And the problem, of course, the key problem is that we at the time did not have equipment that would really control the temperature of the gel at the dye. And with polyethylene, it's a much more critical thing than it is with polystyrene. So the point was that I knew what I wanted to do to polyethylene to make stable foams because of the work with polystyrene, but I didn't know of any way to do it at the time. It turned out this is where, though, I happened to be in California at an ACS meeting, and I went up to our Pittsburgh plant, and Herman Mark was up there giving a lecture, and he started talking about Art Charlesby's work then at Harwell on radiation cross-linking of polyethylene. I said, gosh, that's the way to do it. So I can modify the viscoelastic properties, so I remove the temperature sensitivity in that way. Because what you really want to do is really lengthen out that disentanglement plateau, you know, to make so that you can foam easily and you don't have the resistance, but on the other hand, viscous flow and thinning of the lamella doesn't happen. So we had Bill Beamer, who was working in Dow at the time. He had a 2 million volt. Electron accelerator, and I went over and I devised a piece of equipment so that the orifice was made so I could pass the beam through a thin titanium window, and it through the polymer just before it emerged from the orifice. Very dramatic experiment. It gave you know, you could be making an absolutely lousy foam and turn that beam on and get a nice rectangular cross-section, cell size became uniform. It worked very nice, but also at the same time, with that piece of equipment, I was able to evaluate blowing agents for making the for making foam. And that was something I did not have before with any equipment. But that led me to select a blowing agent, in this case the 1,2-dichlorotetrafluorethane, that has almost the same permeability right through polyethylene that air has. See, and normally what I soon found out, the real key problem was that the permeability of low solubility parameter blowing agents through molten polyethylene is very high compared to what it is through polystyrene. So even as you start to cool, what happens, you blow the foam up, and the fluorocarbon was leaving the foam faster than air could come in. So you were continuously subjecting a relatively soft foam to a positive compression. So what would happen is the foam would just shrink down, and if you might extrude a cross-section that, say, was a foot wide and 2 inches thick, and a matter of a half hour later, it might be 9 inches wide and 1 inch thick. So I was able to apply some of the Hildebrand solubility parameter theory and select blowing agents which had a reasonable probability of having a permeability more in tune with that of air. And it worked, and the consequence of it was that I patented the only really successful blowing agent for polyethylene foam extrusion as a volatile organic type. And it was the foundation of our ethyfoam business for many, many years. We had a lot of headaches with it for a while, selecting feedstock, identifying critical feedstock parameters and all. It was quite a job, but and it took, from the time that we did the original work. I did that work in the early part of 56. And again, Boyer was a very strong supporter. In fact, I've often mentioned to people that very often, as far as getting a new product off the ground, you absolutely have got to have champions for you. As researchers, we provide options for innovation, but if we don't have the champion to back it and to see it through until it can finally be commercialized successfully, we get nowhere. We had an assistant lab director, Bill Nummy, at the time, and of course Boyer was director of polymer research for the company. Those two people supported it very strongly, but from the time that we did the initial work until we were successfully selling some product, we had 4 or 5 years. And over that 4 or 5 years, I would say that 9 out of 10 people who were in management positions wanted to kill it because we never going to make anything out of it. But the persistence of Boyer and Nummy in supporting it ultimately was the reason it finally culminated in a successful product. You can't do it alone. That's all there is to it. If people, if you don't have the support of management that champions these things, you know, you're whistling in the dark no matter how good work you do, as far as I'm concerned.
Ray talks about what's happened at Dow recently in terms of having 50 cash registers instead of one, as he puts it.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
the abominable nomad, is he so apt? Yeah, no, I'll tell you what's happened. And I probably shouldn't be saying this, but I can say it is a... Like I tell Keith McKinnon, you can't fire me now anyhow, so what's the difference? But I see it as this, that I think in a very rapidly going company, and I don't think it matters whether it's Dow or any company, you have such a tremendous need for expanding management globally that you hire a lot of people, a lot of them that don't make it, a lot of them that come to a certain level. Unfortunately, that level is one that is one of power and controlling budget money. And many times those people are not visionaries. So they're sitting there, and they're sitting there with some godlike powers as far as controlling your budget. If your project comes to them and that they're making project decisions that I don't think are predicated on necessarily on sound business or sound scientific judgment. So the net result is that all you got to do to squash the project is withhold the money, and that's it. And it means that now somebody's got a reputation and has done it for a long time. He's probably got places he can go and go beyond those people, but that's not the case for 95% of your younger scientists. But it isn't only Dow. I think it's the entire United States. I think that's why we have not, as a country, innovated as effectively as we should in the last 20 years.
Well, the trend also seems to be that you innovate by acquiring instead of...
Yeah, seeing the other pasture greener than yours, you know. I'm going to have to go and get my police. He's out there, and that's all. The phone business has been an excellent business for Dow. I suppose, like any other researcher, I'm not necessarily enamored in how well it's been handled as a business, because I think we've abdicated a lot of major opportunities that could have been converted into a very successful business. But that's my judgment as against other people. I still see it, as you probably know by reading that publication, that I perceive it as being still a very good growth industry, and I think it'll only increase in importance in the long run as the need for good insulating materials and all and shock mitigating products and that continues to develop. And there's a lot of opportunity there yet today. Boy, I would think today if you got the proper management support for young scientists that there's tremendous opportunity in that area. It's interesting though, as I mentioned to you on the buyer thing, we turned them down, and then of course in 1954 they went to Monsanto and formed Mobay, and Monsanto ultimately had the misfortune to have produced that TDI back in that period between 45 and 50, and then so they got stuck in the antitrust thing and had to divest themselves. But isn't it funny that today, you know, here's Dow is ultimately number two in urethane chemicals in the world behind Bayer. But it took a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I think one thing, Jim Leinhouts, who had been a research director in Dow back in the early 50s, when Dow started producing the Voronols, Jim claims that the reports that we had written on opportunities in urethane chemistry in the late 40s, and that did have an influence on Dow's decision to go in and make the Voronols in Texas. So maybe it wasn't all wasted, you know. These things are complex, and their interactions, and a company as big as Dow, and you just keep doing the best, and hoping that ever so often the things that you do have a chance to catch and amount to something. But, you know, the other aspect of it is that Ray, of course, talks about abominable no men, but I kind of look at it that when we came into the period between 55 and 60 particularly, when they started to realize that Dow had and other American companies had really well-developed processes. They had the capability of making products that could be marketed worldwide. It looked like a good opportunity to expand those products, you know, in plants wherever you had an affluent population. That's the direction they went. There was a lot less risk than there was to take some of our ideas that had never been really proven commercially and try to develop them. All the data, you know, there's a lot of Dow historical data on what it's taken as far as time to develop to develop the average product in Dow. And Jake Eichhorn did an excellent job of looking at what Dow crown jewels, and that he did this back in 1972, the first report he wrote. And he looked at the gestation period from concept to successful commercialization. And, you know, he was looking at the criteria was profitability of $1 million before taxes. But reasonable criteria. And he looked at, like I said, what would have been the crown jewels at that time. And on the average, there's about 10.5 years. And in fact, it ranged all the way from as little as 4 to as many as 35, something like magnesium. But the point there was that the very short times were products that they, you know, they went out and bought the technology, like the ICI technology on high-pressure polyethylene. Those sort of things took long. But where they were internally generated by our laboratories, I think you'd find that the period from 10 to 20 years is a good point. I would have put it longer than that because I could identify what he had taken as initial dates, and I would have put a earlier dates on the ones that I knew by maybe 3 or 4 years. Yeah. So that's a tough thing to handle, and if you're really managing money and optimizing it, I guess you see it that. You know you're going to build a plant in where you got an affluent population that wants your product. There's not much risk. But I think that the people like old Herbert Dow, that they believed that the risk was worth taking. They believed that you prepared yourself for the next business upturn by making the new product, and you were going to capitalize on a new opportunity. But I think it took a different breed of manager. They did well. I always sort of think back when I first came, I think that we were selling $35 million worth of chemicals, and I think DuPont was some 25, 30 times bigger than we were. And their profitability on sales was a factor of 2 bigger, and everything else looked great, see? But, you know, you look by 1974, a Dow at least caught and fast food caught in profitability that year. It was tremendous management, I think, of an expansion of what Dow had. But it may have, the one part of the formula that may have been neglected was the innovation part. Now, of course, they've re-emphasized the fact that we're going to do specialties and we're going to innovate. And it's an interesting thing to see what's going to happen because it takes a special kind of person in management to innovate, I think. It takes a confidence and a championing of your research people and your other people to be able to see it through. And I'm not sure yet that in U.S. industry that the way we manage today is geared to do that.
How many scientists are in management ranks?
Not many anymore. Mm-hmm. Not many anymore, see. They really thinned out. It used to be that many of these people, like, for example, Ben Branch, you know, he had come through with the whole cellulose lab and moved up through management and ultimately became president of the company and CEO and so forth, but the chairman of the board, rather. And there were a lot of people who had come up through research and all, and ultimately were in major positions in the company, like Goggin, who was ultimately president of Dow Corning and so forth. He started the old physics lab and worked his way through, but there were a lot of people, a lot more than there are today. Many of the people today, I think, come because of their abilities to manage business and to manage finances and so forth. And so they are the people who have emerged at the top of the company. And I'm sure they do a good job as far as what they've got to manage. I'm not so sure that the answer to innovating in the U.S. is going to be found in the type of management that's going on.
What about? Well, I gave Ray this quote too. Let me ask you, give it to you as well. I had read somewhere, I guess about a half a year ago, that in the past a lot of basic research was done, and then once something had been found, a need, you went out to try and market it after you developed, after it was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Now the trend is the reverse. That is, you have a need, then you go out to find something to fill the need.
Well, that's an interesting point. Of course, I think the arguments of whether discovery or need-oriented research is the way to go is one that's going to have proponents both ways always. But I got into a little argument with a fella about a year ago on this. I had Forrest Stark, who is director of research at Dow Corning now, come and talk to our scientists. We have a scientist organization, you know, in both the central research and also in the Midland Nastel groups. They're separate groups, but we have speakers come in about once a month. I had Forrest come in, and a lot of this business of outside in versus inside out research is, you know, is being talked about today. And I asked him specifically, I said, well, how much of your work at Dow Corning do you think is based on outside in stimulus to do something? He said, very little. He said, we attempt to be the best there is in silicone chemistry and to have a very thorough basic understanding of what we can do with it. Then, he said, we look at where the market opportunities are for what we know that we can do. So it seems to me that they lead from, you know, from the idea of product strength. That is the thing that I felt that we led from very much years ago in Dow, too. And, of course, as I look at it, their profits and operations still seem to be around 12.7%. Applying that philosophy, and with a lot of our commodity business, at least the way we'd operated, I looked at Dow profit and operations a couple of years back, and it seems to me that it was running around 2.73%, like a lot of the rest of the industry. And so, you know, I can't, I guess I feel more comfortable having an expertise in a certain area. And if someone tells me or identifies an opportunity in the foam area, I can tell them, I think, right off what we can do from the standpoint of science and technology, what kind of economics are involved, whether we have a particular capability of responding to that opportunity or not. I don't have to go and dedicate myself to trying to learn about foams. I think that that's the same thing that you need in the various areas where business opportunities may emerge. You need that kind of technical capability in your organization right at the time, because if you stop to think of the gestation period, as I've talked about, for successful innovation, you know, if you come back and have to resolve the problems before you can do anything, rather than to have some capability of putting something in their potential customer's hand today, I just don't think you can do it. I think people are kidding themselves if they do. Because you need that. I think in any organization that's going to effectively perform, you need that kind of basic knowledge, basic expertise. I would agree wholeheartedly with Ray that was the way to do it.
I was always intrigued by, I think it was H.H. Dow, who actually had different groups within the company competing against each other.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that's right, but I would, I guess I would rather have people reinforcing and cooperative with one another than necessarily competing. I know synergism isn't a good word, but on the other hand, I think if you can if you can get people to interact properly and have the team goals, you can make it work. Yeah, I know this type of controversy theory and that, but I personally don't subscribe to it, but I'm sure other people do, and that neither one of us is probably 100% right.
One of the things that we haven't talked about yet in terms of things that you've developed was the composite systems.
Oh, yeah, those are. Well, you see, the point is that if you look at the open cell flexible urethane cushion systems, there's a certain limit that you can go at a particular density with the so-called load factors and all. The stress strain curve and compression is really nothing more than the flexing of the elastomer struts. And within limitations, you know, maybe a factor of two, you can vary the stiffness of that elastomer. But what you're really looking for is a way of improving the shape of the stress strain curve so that you don't bottom out when you sit in it. And if you were to compare, for example, the load deflection curve for 50% compression of let's say a typical 2 pound per cubic foot urethane cushion foam, you know, you find that it's about a half a PSI when you're 50% compressed. So it also, now the curve is very quickly increasing, and so by the time you come to rest, you may be got very little cushioning action. You're quite uncomfortable. So the idea here was to try to make a pneumatic particle, because if you simply measure the stress strain properties and compression of let's say a closed cell foam, which behaves in a pneumatic manner, now it's going to be 15 psi at 50% compression, just from V1 V1 equals V2 V2. So, say, gee, you know, that's 30 times the load bearing that the open cell foam has. So let's go ahead and figure a way to distribute these pneumatic particles in the open cell foam, and then we ought to develop composite properties where we can just about tailor our load, because if you think of it, with foam particles, the closed cell foam dispersed in the open cell, you don't influence the initial softness very much, because you can still deform the softer phase. But as you start to compact it down, now more and more of the load is being accepted by the closed cell foam. So this is where you ultimately come to a point where you can tailor the shape of the compressive stress strain curve to get just about what you want by controlling the volume fraction of closed cell foam. Well,